Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When I first started in London, and as being part of being an agent, and he said, "Chris, there's 6 jobs in the world you can do really well, probably, and only one of them you will literally starve because it will make you so happy. You'll starve to do that job because it's so much fun, and eventually the money will come and the success will come. But if you follow your heart," and I just stuck with that all my life.
I sit down with Chris Birch, who's the founder of Modiphius, one of the most prolific RPG companies out there right now. We talk about the long and winding road and all the different experiences he had that led to him starting the company. We dig into the idea of Octung, Cthulhu, where it came about, and how it became their first product. We talk about the origins of the 2D20 system and who was involved in making it. And make sure to stick around for our discussion on how he gets licenses for big properties like Star Trek and Conan. At times, you'll hear his mic scratch against his shirt. It can be a little annoying, but I can tell you that this interview is well worth the effort. Chris offers good advice and some very interesting insights at the end on the future of the hobby. I'm able to bring content like this on a weekly basis because of our patrons. So quick shout out to some of our newest patrons: Keller O'Leary, Robert Anthony, Peter Shepard, Jesse Miller, Tony Vicinda, John Harper, Shauna Navi Drake, and Harrigan. Thanks to each of you and all of the other patrons that support me. All right, it's time to sit back, relax, and enjoy my time with Chris.
Do you love to unplug and play games around the table? Greetings, friends and floorheads, to Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars. If you love tabletop gaming, you are in the right place. Listen as Craig delivers in-depth discussions and interviews with game designers, creators, insiders, and experts. Learn from the people making and playing the role-playing, miniature, and board games you love.
Howdy, friends. Craig here. Today, we're talking to Chris Birch, the founder of Modiphius Publishing. Modiphius, since 2012, has brought us some of the biggest games over the past decade. The list is really long, but they're probably best known for their 2D20 games like Octung, Cthulhu, Conan, Star Trek Adventures, Dune, Mutant Chronicles. Outside of the 2D20 system, they've even delivered us the most recent incarnation of the Vampire the Masquerade and a ton of other role-playing games and board games. And Chris, I could spend the next 5 minutes talking about all of it, but instead, how about I welcome you to the third floor?
Hi, thanks for having me.
I appreciate you making the time. So we have a ton to talk about, but before we do, I need your origin story. So at some point, little Chris Birch knew nothing about games and dice and role-playing and board games, and then all of a sudden you saw it for the first time. I'd love to go back there if we could.
Yeah, sure. It's a two-pronged story. So on one hand, I think I was about 8, and my brother Nick and his girlfriend would go on a Wednesday night to the Sylvester's house, this family that they knew, they'd go and play Dungeons and Dragons. And I had no idea what it was, but my mum one week went, "Look, for God's sake, get Chris out of the house. He's stuck inside, take him with you." And they were like, "Oh, all right." So he took me along, and that's where I first played Dungeons and Dragons. It was In Search of the Unknown. They gave me a suit of plate armor, which is always a bad sign. I called my character Brandon Carter, and there's a pit trap at the end of the first corridor after you fight the goblins in Search of the Unknown, and I fell through the pit trap, and he gave me like 3 saving throws. Do you fall? Do you hang on to the edge? Do you get your armor off in time? And I failed every single one miserably, and so I drowned. So that was like a bit of a shock for an 8-year-old. Like, what do you mean? I'm out? They're like, no, you can create a new character. So it's like, okay, son of Brandon. but every time I create a sample character for a lot of our role-playing games, they've been called Brandon Carter.
that's
funny. Every time I create a character for Elder Scrolls or whatever video game, it's Brandon Carter in honor of that first death that got me on the road. And then, you know, from there, I remember getting my first box with the dragon on the front on the pile of treasure and starting to do my own gaming and creating adventures, which were all just mad dungeons with lots of monsters and treasure and magical artifacts. But then equally, roughly around the same time, I think maybe it was a year later, my mum would take me to her sister's who owned a cattery, and I was allergic to cats. And this is in a place called Gloucester, which is a very pretty part of the countryside. So I'd spend the weekend feeling like I had flu, of course, miserable. And anyway, one day we went out for a walk in a local village, and we went into this, I vaguely remember it was a knitting shop, maybe an arts and crafts and knitting shop, but there on the back wall was this wall of little Ziploc bags with games in, well, what looked like fantasy and sci-fi art on that said they were games. Right. So I discovered Ogre, you know, Steve Jackson's Ogre, which is a hex-based ratio combat game. I was terrible at maths, so I spent the weekend scratching my head over ratio combat, like 2-1, 3-1, 4-1 odds and stuff like that, trying to get my head around it, and then would play against myself. And it's, if you don't know the game, it's a big, massive cyber tank versus lots of little tanks and infantry. And you've got to make a decision. Now, do you take out all its treads to stop it moving, or you take out its guns because it's trying to kill your command post? And so it's a great, fun little strategy game. And you can pretty much play it on your own. And I'd get my, and then I got my other brother playing it, and he got into games. My other brother, Al, he got into the board games. Nick eventually fell out, you know, stopped playing role-playing games. But Al, I started doing Napoleonic wargaming with 15mm miniatures when I was about 13, 14. And Al got into it, and then he's stayed with wargaming and gaming all his life. And I was doing 15mm English Civil War because I found a load painted in a bring and buy that were cheap at a war games show in Solihull, which was not far. I grew up in Leamington Spa, like middle of England. Anyway, so I'd beg, borrow, and steal and buy whatever I could that was painted because I just couldn't be asked to paint. And then I was also collecting people's, fantasy miniatures that they didn't want. You know, the Sylvesters gave me some other people had some they didn't want. And I also, there was this, the Prince August molds that you could mold your own fantasy figures. So at age 10, no, actually about age 12, I was melting, you know, molten lead on the kitchen stove, which is probably not, sure it's not a great idea. I remember getting a few nasty burns off that and then literally spray painting them black. And that was fine. And I think I just put a few blobs of green paint on them and all these orcs and knights. So I kind of assembled this big fantasy army and would play out storytelling battles where I'd have like the handful of knights that I had in a bunch of like villages in a village in the middle of the map. And there's the big army advancing them. And then the rest of the hero's army, the archers, the elven archers and others were like on the other side of the map. And it was a desperate last stand. And would they get there in time? I didn't care about balance at all. It was more about telling a story. And I actually found the write-up, I've got it upstairs, of that day when I played that battle and how fun it was. And I tried to do stuff that was way more fun and probably I'd lose, but maybe I could hold on, maybe I could win. And I would just write super simple war game rule sets. And because I was pretty much on my own, there wasn't a war games group in town, let alone anyone who played stuff like that. I came up with my own solo rule sets and learned how to play against myself in a fun way. But yeah, I would come up with event cards and all kinds of systems.
What's funny to me about that, Chris, is I've talked to obviously a lot of creators and designers for the show, and necessity has borne us so many creators.
Oh yeah.
That, like, the story you tell is like I didn't have anybody to play with, or I didn't have the money to buy the book, so I just started making stuff. It's amazing how much the restrictions have given birth to creation.
Yeah, sure. And I think it's also, there isn't a game for X, so I want to make it. So I wanted a fantasy game of, you know, trying to defend a little kingdom against lots of big armies. So I made that with lots of kind of art card and stuff. Made all, this is when you used to be able to buy sheets of die cut counters with no print on them from the gaming stores. So I'd buy those and make my own counters. And I loved this comic book series called Alien Legion. It's the only comic apart from 2000 AD that I ever collected. And it's basically the French Foreign Legion in space with lots of mad aliens, and they always get the brunt of the, you know, rubbish work and, you know, conspiracies against them. And so I created a kind of miniatures game. Well, actually not miniatures, it was counters, but played it like a miniatures game based on that. And, you know, it would be a random, is it Tory Mantrock, I think was one of the main guy. It just popped into my head. It would be a random number of the characters from the squad, and then completely random enemies that they'd have to fight. And I came up with all these objective cards and special event cards. And they might be fighting two tanks and, you know, three sergeants and a bunch of infantry with three guys at some point. But it was always, what could they do? And could they get off the board alive? So it was never, again, about balance. It was never, ever like, oh, I want to have a fair chance of playing this game. And sometimes I'd completely overwhelm the enemy and I'd get loads of cool stuff and upgrade my guys. But it was just the fun of exploring this world where you never knew what was going to happen. I love the fact that, oh my God, I've got a tank. How am I going to, oh no. And then where's it start? Oh God, it's in the middle of the map. So it was great fun. And I've still got that. I found that. I mean, I dug out loads of stuff from the attic a long time ago. So that, yeah, that's the origin story. And then I went through Star Frontiers, Metamorphosis Alpha, Gamma World. I loved all the post-apocalyptic stuff. And that started because my brother Al got into role-playing game. And he's like, oh, okay, let's play a game today. And I just assumed it was going to be Dungeons & Dragons. And I was this pretty rubbish native with a spear. And it, you know, and of course at that age, you're not thinking, wait a minute, these are different stats and this is a different looking character sheet. You're just like, I guess this is Dungeons and Dragons. And soon it became pretty clear that I found a metal wall that went up to the sky. And I found something that I had to roll on these tables to figure out what it was. And I kind of guessed it was a gun, but my character thought it was a hairdryer or something, you know. So, And that was Metamorphosis Alpha, you know, which is James M. Ward's fantastic kind of sort of first post-apocalyptic type game for TSR. Yeah. And that lived with me. That kind of gave me my love for post-apocalypse worlds. This idea of, like, it's not what you think it is. It's actually a big, massive spaceship, or there's all these ancient ruins with technological secrets. And so yeah. I love the art of Gamma World and this sort of fun, kooky where you could be a talking badger or a, you know, walking plant that shot wires at people and stuff. It was so much fun. So I always have a massive interest in post-apocalypse, all the way back to that first game of Metamorphosis Alpha, which and also a love for old fantasy science fiction, because I'd help my grandfather, who had a bookstall in Coventry Indoor Market. So I'd go there and get paid on Saturdays to help sell books. I'd get paid in shopping bags full of Spider-Man comics and Famous Four and Weird War and Sergeant Rock, which was how I came to come up with Acton Cthulhu.
Isn't that funny?
I grew up on a diet of Weird War, like demon-infested tiger tanks. And then discovered, you know, Call of Cthulhu and everything, and thought I can, you know, create a world around that. But I also would come home with Isaac Asimov and the Foundation books and the Thongor Against the God books and the Andre Norton Witch World books. And there was this one book I remember where all the people had forgotten there was West. West didn't exist anymore. You always went east or south. You kind of, they lived in this strip of land, and it was this mind-blowing, like, what?
Yeah, so that's, I loved, interesting.
That was all the kind of stuff that you know, like ancient ruined worlds, lost secrets, lost information,
yeah,
that kind of percolated through and has given me a big love for that sort of genre. So
Well, it's fascinating to me, Chris, that even when you weren't playing role-playing games, narrative was still the king, right? That was the telling of the story and the living of the story that drove you. I'd be curious, though, it's usually at this point in the origin story that we hear one of two things, which is, you know, I kept playing and I found people at university and so on and so forth. Or it is, I discovered, you know, girls or sports or something and I took a break. So I'd be curious for you, Chris, was it a continuous love for you or did you take some time off from gaming?
So at university, I became the chairman of the Gaming Society. So I was
that answers my question.
just as Games Workshop opened in the UK in Birmingham, I think it's the second shop. So we would go there and spend all the university budget on games, and we did big costume Gaming Society balls that left the student union smelling of chicken and cider.
Isn't that something?
After a food fight. So we did all these big lots of live role-playing stuff. But I was also publicity secretary for the Christian Union, which is awesome. So because I just didn't see, there was nothing weird about Dungeons and Dragons. And I remember Christians talking about it and going, oh, it's a bit weird. It's like, well, I run it, it's really normal. Like, and that demon on the front of the book, it's rubbish. Have you seen how crap that art is? It's not even like A-level art. That's like awful. What do you think that's like evil? It's like, it doesn't even look like a monster.
It's just amateur. That's all it is.
Yeah. And then once there was some people visiting, we were running at like, I don't know, 7 o'clock or something. And some new student families were like out on a tour. And just as they opened the door, I went, and then Satan said... So, I think Jesus would pee himself laughing at The Life of Brian. I remember when Life of Brian was banned as a kid, and I was like, this is hilarious.
I know,
God would laugh at this. Like, of course, people at the edge of the crowd would be mishearing what Jesus said and go, what do you mean, blessed are the cheesemakers? I mean, of course that would happen. It's like, it's funny. Like, so... anyway, so I didn't see any barriers there and just carried on. So, but then I left college and became a band manager and entered the club scene in London. So I was touring big rave bands to all the big dance parties and going to clubs till like 6 in the morning, Friday and Saturday night. So I was burnt out. So I kind of left gaming for a bit. There was one friend that Stuart Newman, who I ended up writing Star Blazer Adventures with my first game, and we would play massive battles of 40K and Epic and Star Wars the miniatures game when it was old metal miniatures and make up all our own rules so we could use all the miniatures, not just I mean, none of those games really could manage all the, you know, the basic numbers of miniatures, but we wanted to use everything on the table. I had giant battles, so we would just make stuff up. But I was kind of in the full-on club scene for gosh, maybe 5 years, and then came back to it. Went to a gaming shop, going, "Oh, I wonder how it's changed." You know, must look really cool. And all the books were still black and white, and still pages of text looked awful, like really terrible. And now I'm used to like, you know, then I've seen everything else in the real world. I was like, why can't it be better?
Yeah.
And we started playing games a lot with my friend Stuart and would come up with lots of mad ideas that, you know, we'd play till 6 in the morning, sometimes eating cold pizza and drinking Diet Coke and dreaming up gaming worlds. And at one point I was working on a project and met Mike Pondsmith, who I knew I was going to meet Mike Pondsmith, who wrote Cyberpunk. And so we put this little game together called Blaster Array, which a bit like Savage Worlds, it uses different dice for different weapons.
Stats.
Yeah, it's different stats. And it was a role-playing game, and it was set in a artificially created solar system called Modiphius.
Nice.
And we always said we'd start a games company one day. So when I came to start Modiphius, I was like, that's the name I'm going to use, of course, you know, because it came from the word modified. It was a modified solar system.
Interesting.
And it's very easy to find a .com name if you make a word up.
<That's true.
laughs> So that was good. So I kind of, you know, had been on my way a long way and then came back and just dove into, you know, playing war games again, and, you know, a lot of the war, you know, the 40K stuff, and because he was a great painter, so I could never paint miniatures. I would buy stuff painted off eBay. Still do.
That's hilarious. Well, Chris, yeah. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I was going to say, but I can paint ruins. I can dry brush stuff. So I can paint scenery and tanks.
So we know you can put the undercoat on. We know you can use the spray can and you can dry brush, but that's the limit of your talent.
Yep, that's it. Yeah.
That's great. Well, that's going to transition us right into the next segment. So guys, the Insider Insight series is my opportunity to sit down with designers, developers, artists, writers, and creators and learn how they approach their work. I try to understand their process, inspiration, and methods for crafting their creations. We've got to do all of that with Chris. So let's take a quick break and let's come back and let's talk about where we were headed, which is the creation of Modiphius. We'll be right back.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Are you a tabletop RPG player that is considering becoming a game master? Are you a veteran GM that is always looking for different ways to improve your games? GM Mastermind is an RPG podcast that tackles topics catering to the art of game mastering.
But Craig, there are a lot of RPG podcasts that do that.
Perhaps. But GM Mastermind has the brain trust. It's a guest panel made up of 2 to 3 game masters from different backgrounds and experiences that share their personal insights on a particular topic. This keeps the conversation fresh, diverse, and insightful from one episode to the next. So head over to gmmastermind.com or subscribe to GM Mastermind wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
So we've already teased and know where the name came from. And we also know that if we're playing Elder Scrolls Online, we know if we're playing with Chris Birch, because we know what your character's name is going to be. Mm-hmm. But I want to go back to, you know, it sounds like you and your friend were dreaming of someday we'll have a gaming company. Can we get a sense of when that becomes more of a possibility? So where were the earliest seeds of, I think we're going to try something?
Sure. Well, I was working with a guy called Terry Jervis, one of my weird different jobs. I'd been a rave promoter, an agent for bands, and then started working for this guy Terry for a couple of years on TV development and production. And he was kind of really interested in gaming, and we were developing a science fiction show and a animated kind of superhero pharaoh from the past whose spirit inhabits the body of an R&B pop star today. Hilarious. So we were kind of developing lots of games around that, and me and Stuart, we did all the writing for the background for both the projects to help out. And then after that, we got I met a director called Andy Wilson, a UK TV director, and pitched him, and he got his production company to pay us to write the background for a big TV sci-fi series he was developing. So we were like, oh my God, we got money for writing science fiction storyline. And the idea was like, we're not writing the plot. We're writing what's around the other corner. Like what
interesting
the stuff that makes the plot make sense.
Right.
You know, and helps the script writers. So they loved it. And, so we did that job, and then, so I knew I was going to meet Mike Pondsmith, and we had this game Blaster Array that we had created. And I kind of copy pasted loads of art from Star Frontiers and Travel and all kinds of stuff just to illustrate it, and gave him a copy when I meet him. And he's such a lovely guy. He's like, oh, Chris, thanks very much. It's really cool. You never mentioned it again, bless him. I mean, but we became good friends, you know, in later years. And he always, I remember him seeing him after a long time, and he'd walk past our stand at Gen Con. It's like, that name Modiphius rings a bell. It's like, yeah, man, it's that book I gave you a long time ago. Do you remember? And it was the name of the solar system. He's like, oh, wow.
Isn't that funny?
So, and then I guess where it really came together was I helped Cubicle 7 get the rights to Doctor Who, because I now had a T-shirt company called Joystick Junkies that I've been doing for several years, and was doing a lot of licensing work with video games companies, licensing their brands to put on our T-shirts. So I knew what to do and what they wanted to hear. So I kind of helped them go into the BBC. I got the contact and helped them do the pitch. And that's when it was Angus Abrantson and Dom, Cubicle 7. So I was also looking at doing some T-shirts around a brand called Starblazer. It was an old British comic book. A lot of the 2000 AD artists would work on it before they went on to 2000 AD. It was a 70-page kind of little digest format comic, a bit like the Commando comic, if anyone's ever seen that. And it was 70 pages of one story, all black and white interior and beautiful color sci-fi covers. So I said, look, this is great artwork. You know how awful most of those art role-playing games are because they've got no art. This would give you tons of art. And they were like, that's a great idea. Why don't you write it? So in a fit of madness, I said, sure, and enrolled my friend Stuart. So, okay, we're writing a role-playing game. And now the weird story is I was looking at Fate at the time, which I looked at loads of games to figure out what to base it on. I'm thinking, I'm not going to write a new system that's used something that's out there that ideally we could use, you know, for a low or no royalty, just, you know, because there's no money in it. So Fate had Spirit of the Century had just come out. There was royalty on Fate. But anyway, we looked at that, and we looked at PDQ, that was the Zorcer of Zoe by Chad Undercoffer. Which was a great little system, very, very, very simple. And if we'd used that, the game would be about 1/30th of the 636 pages it ended up being. We decided to rewrite Fate. We rewrote Spirit of the Century, that was a pretty big book in its own right, and then added an enormous setting material. We basically took all the cool ideas that were floating around for Fate, like, you know, sort of plot, threat generation, plot generation, plot stress, and how to fight civilizations as well as fight characters, and put it all into this one massive book. And I was thinking, well, I just want to do the one book. I don't want to have millions of supplements. And so it ended up being this huge, huge tome of space opera goodness. And that was our first book. And you know, this is before the days of Kickstarter, and they did a pre-order, and you know, I think it did all right for them. And then I went back to being a fashion designer for, you know,
I'm losing track of your career, Chris. Yeah, you've done so many things. It's amazing.
When I go back to school and give them careers lessons, sometimes the kids go, is it normal to have so many different jobs? It's like, no, not really. But I've always followed my heart, you know. There's a guy called David Grant. He's a pop singer in the UK, and I road managed him for when I first started in London, and as being an agent. And he said, Chris, there's six jobs in the world you can do really well, probably, and only one of them you will literally starve, because it will make you so happy. You'll starve to do that job because it's so much fun. And eventually the money will come and the success will come. But if you follow your heart, and I just stuck with that all my life. And it's definitely starved a few times.
you're not swimming in your swimming pool of money quite yet.
Oh, I know. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, when I first worked in the music business, it's all very glamorous and great and free parties and guest lists and everything. But you get paid nothing.
Right, you eat noodles when you get home.
The buzz is, you know, I would, when I first started, I would go, I was an A&R guy, so I'd go and see bands looking for cool bands to represent. And they would say, look, you can expense your food, So I would go to this like place called Stockpot in Soho that's like £5. So now about $7. But back then, I guess it, you know, it was probably the equivalent of, you know, £8. $10 for $10 a three course meal. And you sit really close to other people, so you kind of meet other people. And I'd eat that, and then I'd go and see two or three bands and have a bottle of beer at every band. So I'd get my money and travel car paid for. So I would go out literally every night of the week seeing bands.
So you could eat.
So I could, yeah, which paid for my food. And I would find bands, and I was always there before the record companies were there, because I was getting really good at finding stuff. And yeah, anyway, so you know, I've done a few jobs that, you know, didn't really pay well, and you know, including fashion to start with. That, you know, it was our own little business. It took a while to get going, and then Kickstarter came along, and I'd got married. And my wife Rita said, look, you know, what do you want to do? Do you really want to do clothing?
Because you know, do you want to be an adult now?
Yeah, exactly. Do you want to grow up, get a life? I just sold a load of painted Flames of War stuff for about $1,500 and paid for our first holiday, which she couldn't believe. She was like, is this trash worth that much? It's like, oh my God.
It is.
So we had a, you know, so that was like our first time. And then we went to Belarus because she's from Belarus, and I met a guy who knew some companies that made plastic tanks for Russia and stuff. And I was like, maybe I could do that, but it's not really a big market. And then came back to the UK. I'd recently read At the Mountains of Madness.
Oh yeah,
by H.P. Lovecraft, and of course my weird war Sergeant Rock educated head had immediately gone, yeah, but what if there were Nazis at Antarctica? So I started coming up with all these ideas, and I dreamt up the name Acton Cthulhu. And just at that point, I met Sarah Newton, who's her company is Mind Jammer Press, and she had some adventures set in World War II with Cthulhu for the Call of Cthulhu system. And I was like, well, look, let's use that for this world, and I'll market it. And we got this guy, Dean Martin, to work on a royalty for layout, and Michal Cross, who's our lead graphic designer now, joined as the graphic designer. We just did this first PDF called Three Kings, which sold 1,000 copies, because I used to run a PR company as well.
Right.
And we did the first internet PR in the UK for video games companies. So we were the first people talking to websites going, will you cover this? Or here's a freebie to give away. And
right.
So, yeah, I managed to get 1,000 people to buy it over the course of a year. And we launched the second one, and that sold 1,000. And we built up 1,000 strong mailing list. And then Kickstarter announced that they were going to launch in the UK. And I was pretty much sick of the fashion game at this point. So a lovely guy called Paul Wedgwood, I knew, who had a company called Splash Damage, that if anyone's played any of the multiplayer Quake and they're really good at multiplayer games. And he offered me some freelance work to help them do some merchandising. So I went to my company and said, look, I don't want to work in the office anymore. I'm going to work from home for 4 days. Well, I'm going to come into the office one day a week. I'm going to work 2 days of the week for you. And I'm going to do my own stuff for a couple of days a week and do all this, you know, some freelance work and start working on my own projects a bit more.
Yeah.
And we thought we'd get like $15,000-$20,000 doing this, you know, an Acton Cthulhu source book for Call of Cthulhu and Savage Worlds. And it did £250,000.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Once you took into account the post, you know, back of it. And yeah, it was massive. And, you know, halfway through, we hired Michal full time. And I was like, can't go back to t-shirts after this. This is like, if I'm going to do it, a good proper job, because we funded 10 books and a bunch of clothing and miniatures and all kinds of stuff. So so we went full time, and that was the company. So we was me and Rita. Rita would, you know, send out PR emails and do the accounts and help with whatever needed doing, and I would, you know, coordinate all the production and stuff and creative work, and that was 2013. when we incorporated as a company.
So I'd be curious, Chris, I want to take a bit of a step back because you kind of just threw this out here, but I think it's significant. You're like, well, I wrote this and I, you know, I put this together and stuff like that. Like going back to like writing for the TV show and things like that. I mean, looking now as, you know, a decade or so later, looking back on it, where did your ability to just write and for people to go, this is good and we're going to use this? Where do you think that came from?
Well, I guess I was writing a lot of role-playing stories and adventures as a kid. I also wrote lots of stories, endlessly, like writing ideas for worlds and scenes and just concepts that I had. You know, I'd write lots of introductions to role-playing adventures and maybe never played them with people, just enjoyed doing it.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed writing lots of fiction. And you know, I've got a big fiction book I've been working on for, God, 15 years that I used to write on my BlackBerry on the way to work. And so I guess that practice helped. And also, you know, I was lucky, I had a good education and, you know, did English literature to A level. And then just, you know, a lot of it is just practice. And and because we were writing background, we were basically writing an art role-playing game setting chapter. We weren't writing fiction so much for them. So we were writing the, well, this race comes from here and this is their ancient technology and this is the secrets and this is the plots and this is how it fits together. Mm-hmm. So that worked really well. And, you know, ever since I've enjoyed writing fiction, and I'll often write, when I create a role-playing world, I create the main characters that are the Avengers of that world, or the, you know, the Luke Skywalker. Who's the Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia of this story? Because people care about, I can't just write, well, there's these knights over here and these elves over here, and there's this war going on and there's this cool stuff going on. I have to start with the actual personal story. So you care about Star Wars because you love Han Solo and R2-D2 and 3PO and everyone. And you also love the ships and stuff. But it's, of course, it's
an extension of that.
It's the first film that got us to love that world. And so I, you know, Acton Cthulhu wasn't just another weird war story. It was a story of six heroes who are pretty twisted. You know, you've got a professor who can read Cthulhu mythos books and it doesn't send him mad. So what pact did he make in the past? You've got a French girl who's bound to a demon from Roman times because it was the only way to stop it killing her. But now she has to feed it Nazi souls. She has to find Nazi souls every few days for it to feed on. But she's, of course, part of the resistance. You've got a Belarusian tank driver who's possessed by the spirit of the Russian motherland. And a bit like that bit in Hellboy, you know, when I've got the name, the girl who explodes with fire says, "You better run." She's like that. Like, you know, when she lets go, this force of nature explodes out of her body and kills everything around her. So I love dark heroes where they're not just, they're perfect good guys. All of them have problems that in a normal world, the allies would probably go, "We're locking you up and we're going to throw away the key." And actually, you're the bad guys.
Right.
So I love that sort of stuff. So anyway, so I start with characters that I think people are going to relate to and love and their trials and tell their story. And the world kind of fills in around it. So we're working on a big new project we're unveiling this summer. And I started with the heroes and their story. And now we're kind of dialing back and going, well, 6 months before that, what's the role-playing world of that?
Yep.
And how does that kind of sit in, you know, behind the story? So I think storyline has always been important for me.
Very interesting and character driven, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds to be like the driver for you. So let's go back in time now that you say, okay, Kickstarter's out there. We can use it here in the UK. I'm going to go ahead and launch this Octoon Cthulhu thing. We'll see if it, you know, sell £5,000 worth of it and see what happens. How quickly did all of a sudden you log in and look and go, holy crap, like this is a situation?
Well, we hit the target. The target, I think, was 10,000 pounds day one. Well, actually, I think, yeah, I think it was, yeah, it was like 11 hours or something. No, sorry. It was about a day. And we were like, wow, okay. Because I'd just seen all these. This was like before the really big Kickstarters. This is where there was like, I think Numenera was the first like $500,000 Kickstarter for a role-playing game line. And Fate had a big one. And, you know, but it was all around the $200,000-$500,000. And there was five of them. And then there was lots that struggled to get, you know, I saw a lot of things. I thought that's basically our thing. I was doing a lot of market research, comparing ourselves and going, you know, we're probably going to get $10,000 or $20,000. I had no concept that we would do that well. But of course, I had a PR company before, so I knew how to promote ourselves. So I went out. I'd been lucky to get a list of the press from Gen Con, because if you exhibit at Gen Con, if you exhibited at Gen Con, you'd get a copy of the press list, which is about 600 press emails, so that you as an exhibitor could use them to promote your products. So I got that, and then I tracked every similar Kickstarter to us and Googled their title and found all the websites they appeared on, went to those websites, found the editorial contact or the submission page and added it to a list, and then I did it again. And I did it again, and I did it again. I probably did it like 10, 15 times, and we ended up with over 1,000 press.
Which, so you're telling me that it actually took work to be successful.
Yeah, it actually was a real, a long, and you just kept thinking, surely this is enough. And I was like, no, I'm going to keep going. And then what we did is we emailed every single one personally. There was no blanket email. I mean, of course we did once we got going. But that first time we launched, it was like, hey, Craig. How's the podcast going? Just want to let you know, I've just started this game and we're launching on Kickstarter. It's just come out and I would love you to have a look at it. And it's just the amount of responses we got was phenomenal, and interviews and, you know, so much. Of course, people respond to a personal email more than they do clearly a newsletter. So that worked. And, I was nearly going to do a book on how to market yourself for free, which I wrote during that Kickstarter. And then we've been too busy in 10 years since then to.
You've put out a few things since then.
Yeah. I keep looking back at the manuscript and going, I could probably update that and stick it out. But I always talk about it at seminars I do, and so try and give away free advice. So it was day one we were like, wow. And then over the next, you know, daily it was growing, and we got to, you know, 50 grand, 100 grand, you know, eventually ended at 177,000, and then we got another 70,000 extra backers and afterwards. So
And Chris, at that time, I personally was not into role-playing games. I had taken the break that I had talked about for other people, and kind of missed this whole era of which is really a very interesting era that has led to where we are today, right? This window and the discovery of tying, you know, Kickstarter to all of this and itch and just the creation of the creation of PDFs and things. Just a new way to distribute these games. When you know you have the Kickstarter out there and you start hearing feedback come in, so you start hearing the buzz, right? You've got all these people you've contacted, people are talking about this. There was obviously something different about what you had created, and I'd be curious, I mean, it sounds like you knew what it was, but what were other people saying about Octone Cthulhu, and was any of it surprising to you?
Well, I mean, because I didn't do it, I didn't just go, I've got a mad idea, I'm going to stick it up. I kind of did some research of, like, World War II projects are really big in gaming on Kickstarter. Call of Cthulhu projects are generally pretty big. Savage Worlds projects are generally pretty big. Cthulhu Mythos stuff were generally pretty big. So I thought, okay, there's four ticks in the box there for extra potential support. We're hitting lots of different audiences.
Right.
So that was my kind of like, okay, and then I've got my PR experience, and then I've got the it's a new project, and then I've got the audience we've already got, the sort of 1,000, 2,000 mailing list we had. So I thought, okay, that gives us a really good chance. And I nearly was going to do miniatures to start with, And then I thought, you know what? No, we need to get the world right before we do the miniatures. And then we ended up adding the miniatures in to the project. But I've still got in our Kickstarter projects, the very first one is the one I sort of said, because you can't delete it. It says, you know, remove this. And it's the very first miniatures one we were going to do.
Isn't that something?
So it's quite funny. So it was more, I think, that I did that work beforehand to go, what are all the things I can do to make this as surefire a success as can be? And for success for me was getting $10,000.
Sure.
Because that meant I could probably spend a day a week working at it, working from home with my wife. So,
but I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, you've reached out to all of these media outlets, for lack of a better word, and you were getting feedback, right? People were talking about the game. They were saying, this is what I'm reading. This is what I'm seeing. And you know, that would be in my, and if I'm wrong, tell me, that would be the first time you got any type of larger feedback on what you had created. And I'd be curious to know what that feedback was and what your reaction to it was.
I mean, we'd obviously started talking about the game in the year run up to it through the Three Kings adventures. And the whole pitch was Acton Cthulhu, the secret war has begun. So the whole pitch was, this isn't, and there'd been the Savage Worlds weird war role-playing game.
Right.
That's vampires and werewolves and monsters, zombies in World War II. And there's lots of Nazi zombie movies. So my thing was like, okay, there's that, but there's no deep story behind that. Acton Cthulhu, that is just one little fragment of this whole epic universe. And we're going to take you on this deep dive into World War II, into all the secret bases and the secret plots and these strange organizations that were fighting each other so that the history books were written the way you know them to be.
Interesting.
And so we got, we had lots of great feedback on, oh, this is new. So, you know, of course, oh, so it's Call of Cthulhu and World War II, you know. Why had no one thought about that before? You know, so we were lucky to be the first people to do it. And at the same time, Cubicle 7 launched a kind of Cthulhu, I forgot the name now, Cthulhu World War II project as well. So, you know, it was good timing. And, you know, by having Call of Cthulhu and Savage Worlds rules in the book, it meant we hit the kind of pulp players who are at one end of the spectrum and the Call of Cthulhu, everything's dangerous, you're going to go mad and die.
I hate my character crowd.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, yeah, we were able to pull in a lot of people. And, yeah, I mean, the response was great. You know, it was like you've got something that's different. But, I mean, it wasn't so big a response that we were like, oh, my God, we're going to do so much on this. I was still thinking, you know, we'll be lucky to do 10 grand.
Isn't that
and it's going to be hard work. So.
Well, I would imagine, too, and you created it, right? So it didn't surprise you, but I would imagine it must have been validating, I'll say, that, you know, weird war is not a new idea. that predated Acton Cthulhu by a long shot, even within the industry, right? People were already playing games, role-playing games like that. But for it to be identified as this is different, that must have been very validating for you to hear that.
Well, and it was just all the people, the 1,700 backers that came out and put their money down and a lot of money down as well, like to say, you know, we want this. So that was amazing. And I remember Rita, I think Rita, my wife, had just been helping and thinking, you know, he'll probably go back to the T-shirt company and just couldn't believe it. Like, what do you mean people are paying this much money and where's it all coming from? And why do people want to spend so much money on this, your mad idea? And yeah, she's now head of operations and, you know, helps me look after 40 people.
Isn't that something? It's
incredible how it's grown. And, but you know, so that, I mean, it was probably one of the best moments of our life was that kind of dawning realization over the last couple of weeks of like, oh my gosh, our life has changed.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Now, did you know at that point, like, this is what I'm going to do? This is my go forward now. Or was it like, you know, we're going to fulfill this and, you know, then we'll see what happens? Or did you know, like, this is Modiphius is a thing now?
Yeah, I think, well, Modiphius was a thing as a brand.
Right.
But I think, yeah, we'd already started the company because we knew we needed the company to run it. But it's, I think, you know, the second week of the project was like, this is much bigger than we thought it was.
Yeah.
And I think by the third week I was saying to my company, in the company, I'm going to leave.
Unbelievable.
You know, I'll help you transition, but you don't need me.
And, yeah.
So that was fine. And, yeah. And we were making plans and I'd already started thinking about, okay, we've got to deliver this, but also the money will run out at some point. And also we can't just use the Kickstarter money to live off. But of course, but we budgeted it to have some money of that, which I always say, people, you have to pay yourselves enough money so that you don't have to get a bank loan to pay your mortgage. You have to pay yourselves. Don't be a cheap role-playing creator. Now, it's fine if you've got a job and you just want to do this for a bit of fun and you don't need to make any money and you want to pay everyone great money, that's great. But if you want to set it up as a company and pay people professionally, then you've got to budget it properly and go, what can we afford to pay people that's fair? What do we have to pay ourselves for the duration of the period to guarantee this comes out? How are we going to get it into shops so there's more money coming in from all this work we've done? Who's going to distribute it? And then at some point, we have to have another project because the money has to keep going if we're going to employ people. We can't.
And there's a runway, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of people, I mean, we've been late with lots of projects. People go, oh, why are you starting another project? You know, you should finish this one. It's like, well, okay, but we employ people, right? And if yeah. if I said to you, I'm really sorry, that project you're working on hasn't finished, so we can't pay you next month. Because we can't finish we've got to finish the project first. We're not going to start another project that will bring in money to pay your wages. So it's really unfair. So you've got, as a business owner, you've got to think, how do I look after everyone? How do I protect people's wages that protect their jobs? And how do we also get stuff finished, you know?
Right.
You know,
it's
and
not
so
just you and your wife at the kitchen table at this point.
Yeah, no. So, within by the second year, it was like four of us and also lots of freelancers. So again, freelancers are relying on your money because you said, oh, I've got loads of artwork for you to do. I've got loads of writing work for you to do. So, you know, we did Mutant Chronicles year two. So, within the year one, I was already talking to them going, well, let's reboot that and get the license and, you know, we'll start a big project. And, you know, that was 20 books, I think. So it was an insane Kickstarter, which we're still selling. Grew from there. And so you always have to think ahead at yeah. some point. The projects that are doing really well for us now won't be doing as well. And so what can I have to think about it now, because to get it to the point where it could generate money, you've got to sort of start bringing it into the system.
So when you look back, Chris, do you think that you're desire to chase passion, to jump around and try all of these different careers, do you think that prepared you to be smart this entire process?
Yeah, 100%. Because if I look back, I remember doing jobs going, wow, you know, that was just a waste of time. And actually, every single job I did prepared me for Modiphius.
That's
so
something.
Everything, nothing. And there was, you know, there was a company that went bust, you know, but actually that process moved me into another job, and then I learned everything that all those jobs I did were like, well, this, you know, the event management, the marketing, the design, our fashion company, we would have to do about 200 new SKUs twice a year, 400 new products. And that might be a belt, but a belt is like, well, what's the pattern on the belt, and what's the leather, and what's the material, and what's the buckle? And a shirt is, well, how much is the stitching? It's incredibly complex.
Right.
So when I came into role playing, people were like, oh, you funded 10 books. How are you ever going to do it? It's like, trust me.
This is easy.
This is like me having a holiday from life, you know? And then, and also because we did the bags, we did this beautiful bag in China and t-shirts and and people are like, oh, it's so complicated. It's like, yeah, but I, you know, that's my career. So it was, yeah, relatively easy going. And so as we added more and more, you know, in my head, it was like, well, this is quite normal, really. Sure. Luckily, we have a very big team to handle all the mad ideas now, and we try and try and keep it under control.
So. Oh, that's incredible. It, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Like as you were walking me through it, Chris, I was like, oh, I'm starting to make the connections, you know, as you talk through it. So guys, let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, we've kind of understood now how Modiphius came to be, why it, I mean, it's much more obvious to me now, the success that Modiphius has had and how it has gone from nobody knew what it was to now I'm one of, if not the major players in the industry. But now I wanted to also talk to Chris a little bit about systems. We've talked about worlds. Let's talk about systems. We'll be right back. You like science fiction, right? You love playing games, maybe even role-playing games. But what if you can't get your friends together for a game night? If you love games like Mothership or Orbital Blues, check out Deadbelt, a card-based space western solo strategy RPG about skillful and desperate scavengers picking over the remains of junked starships in hopes of a juicy payday. In it, you deal with lurking dangers, push your luck, and walk away with enough cred to keep on flying. Of course, you might get eaten by lurking aliens, or run afoul of rival scavengers, or face the murderous ghosts of long-dead spacers. No one said life in the Dead Belt was going to be easy. For more information on this and all of Sean and Abby Drake's games, swing over to acoupleofdrakes.com. The link's in the show notes. So I've gotten a strong sense, Chris, of what drives you from a storyteller standpoint. I've got a strong sense of the origins of that, kind of your approach to that, your methodology of it, the character, you know, the character-centric storytelling. I do want to talk about mechanics a little bit. So it sounds like you were also as a kid fiddling around with mechanics and you know, piecing that together. Where is the origins of the mechanics that really have become signature for Modiphius? Where can we go back and start to trace where those came from?
Well, we developed our 2D20 system for the Mutant Chronicles game.
Right.
So our second Kickstarter. And I, you know, I've always fiddled around with mechanics. You know, it's yeah, I'm not a big fan. I'm not big in maths, but there's something about, you know, the what dice you roll and the, you know, what is the process of the mechanics that makes it fun and replicates the system, you know, the experience. And so we knew we wanted to come up with our own system, you know, going forward, because, you know, it's great working with, you know, Chaosium and Call of Cthulhu and Savage Worlds, but, you know, you're paying a royalty, you've got to get approvals. We just want to do our own thing and control it. So I remember originally it was 5D20, and I was in my dad had this little cottage in France. We were there on holiday, and I was rolling dice, imagining this big fight scene between Algaroth, this kind of evil god in the Mutant Chronicles universe, this sort of big general, and a whole bunch of heroes, and they were rolling 5D20, getting successes and spending them on loads of cool stuff, like doing all these awesome things. And Michal Cross, our designer, is also a systems guy. And, you know, we would talk about lots of ideas and go, well, that's really crazy because, you know, you need a scale. So right. We kind of got back to 2D20 as a starting point. But one thing I've learned is it's great to come up with the ideas, but there's always someone better than you. And if you're going to do a really good job, find someone who's better than you at what you do and help them do it. So we found Jay Little. He'd obviously worked on FFG's Star Wars game and X-Wing, and pitched an idea. Said, look, we've got this bare bones concept of how 2D20 works, and the whole idea was that you roll 2D20 versus your combination of stat and skill, trying to get under the total. And then there was the idea that you could buy extra dice, so you could get up to 5 D20,
right.
But at cost, you know, that would cost you a resource that the GM would get called threat or doom, I think in Mutant Chronicles, and the GM can spend that to do fun things to you. and so Jay basically helped us turn it into professionally yeah. written gaming system, and we really needed that. And yes, we probably could have done it, and it would have been a bit broken, and maybe would have been fixed after a bunch of errata. But, you know, again, I'm a big believer in don't be too precious. You know the limits you've got. Go and get help and get the best help you can to create something awesome. And we would, you know, we'd been paid a lot of money, 150 grand, to create the Mutant Chronicles role-playing line. So let's pay someone some money to help us create the structure for that. And then, you know, everyone, that will make the development of the game much easier. Then the tale of that is that one of the writers I hired to work on some of the books was a guy called Nathan Dowdle, who'd been working on FFG's 40K role-playing game, and he was a fan of Mutant Chronicles as well, and he just ended up doing a lot of system stuff. And Nathan's now our lead designer, so he's kind of taken on the helm of being the guardian of 2D20 internally. And another guy, Ben Beaton, who's also one of our writers, who's also worked on Mutant Chronicles and Infinity, and he's very much a kind of stats guy that kind of helps with the probabilities and things when we check stuff out. So Nathan's done a fantastic job of reinventing 2D20 every time we need it, and we've been really lucky and flexible, because we change it. It's the core is like roll 2 20-sided dice and try and get under a number, and you can buy more of them, and you can spend those successes to do cool stuff. But sometimes you might add 2 attributes together, in the case of John Carter, and you can choose which ones. Do you charge someone with daring and something else? I can't remember the name of the stat. But like, whereas the princess might shout at them and use daring, you know, mm-hmm. and have the equal same effect of making the enemy lose.
It's very unique.
Yeah, and then Star Trek did it slightly differently. Dune is doing it a bit differently as well. It's a bit like a range of cars. You know, Volkswagen have basically an engine that works a similar way. They've got a system, and they change the engine a little bit for every car. But it's basically a car on 4 wheels, you know.
Yep, yep. Interesting to me about it, yeah. Chris, though, is the way that you piece those together, right, to come up with the target, to come up with what you're shooting for. And this, and again, this is making more sense now that I understand your background better, is still narratively driven, right? So you're having the mechanics drive the narrative. And this is how the princess is going to do it. This is how the John Carter is going to do it. This is how the pirate was going to do it. And you piece it together. And it's super vivid in Star Trek, the way that negotiation between the person running the game and the players works out. So Jay Little's been on the show, extremely clever guy, clever guy, and a super nice guy to boot. But what I would like to figure out is, what condition was it in when you said, here, Jay, this is what we're thinking, versus what you got back?
I think we had like pages of like the rough systems, like turn order and actions and the concepts of dice and stuff, but he really chopped it up and gave it a lot better structure. We had some mad ideas in there that went out, and new stuff that he brought in. Of course it went through iterations, but we ended up with a professional role-playing system that someone would pay money for.
now,
so, and that's what he was good at.
Yeah, obviously. So I'd be curious, as Jay was tossing things back and forth and iterating for you, this is before playtesting, really, right? Where he was really trying to grok the mechanics of it. Can you think of something or a few things maybe that he came back with and you're like, oh, wow, never would have thought of that, or that's really interesting. Did he surprise you?
If I'm honest, I don't remember.
That's okay. Yeah, that's
it was,
okay.
Yeah, it was, there's been a lot of...
it's been a little bit of time.
A lot of water under the bridge since. Yeah. But it was, you know, it was, I think the process was a few months, you know, 3 or 4 months before we then dived into full on playtesting. And then we kind of took it over with the playtesting side and, you know, we talked to him about feedback and stuff. And, you know, but his job was like turn our crazy ideas into a sensible idea that, you know, that works, you know, not just, well, we've got some cool ideas for a role-playing game and, you know, and that really, you know, really helped us. So, you know, it was well worth getting him involved.
Yeah. Now, maybe another way to phrase what I'm thinking about is what do you remember his reaction, right? So you say, hey, Jay, we'd like to do this for you. Here's kind of what we're thinking. You hand it over. And was Jay like, oh, this is interesting. I've got some ideas. Or Jay was like, what the hell is this?
I think he was probably very polite. I'm sure he was like, this is a hot mess, but I probably can fix it.
It's a good thing you hired me is what he's thinking.
Yeah. You made the right decision, guys. You know.
Oh, that's funny. That's
and
funny.
Here's my bank account.
So we've talked about just, and we've been hinting at all of these games that have come out of Modiphia. So I want to take a quick break and I want to come back and I want to talk about them because each of them is unique, though that there's you've already heard the kind of a through line in thinking and mechanics between a lot of them. So let's take a quick break. Let's come back and let's talk about all of these IPs as well. So we'll be right back.
This is Sean. You may have heard of me from such movies as Brett and Sean Go to Illinois, Two Motorcycles, One Stick of Dynamite, and Gaming and BS. What kind of RPG podcast is that? After my NFTs were stolen, I decided to become a patron of Third Floor Wars. The content is great, and it costs me less than a good shot of liquor. So consider becoming a patron. It may just land you your next big role. Head over to patreon.com/thirdfloorwars. Tell Craig Sean sent you.
So we have Octon Cthulhu. Then we've got Mutant Chronicles comes out of that. These are original worlds. These are original concepts or your take on, you know, other things, but they were distinctly yours. What was the first time where you said, I'm going to take my licensing experience, my marketing experience, and I'm going to go out and I'm going to grab a property and bring it into the fold?
Well, that was Mutant Chronicles.
Oh, you know what? I guess I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I knew the people who had the rights because I'd been talking to them about clothing just a couple of years ago about doing t-shirts because they also own the rights to Conan. And we, you know, been friendly. And when the games company had started, I was like, oh, actually, we could do something with that. And then, you know, I also pitched for Conan. And they were like, okay, let's get Mutant Chronicles first. And then Mutant Chronicles was a success. And then.
Yeah.
We also pitched and got the rights to Thunderbirds, the British TV puppet show about, you know, international rescue. And we teamed up with Matt Leacock to do a board game based on that. And that did really well. That was like £250,000. And Matt did a fantastic job. And obviously he was fresh from pandemic and, you know, lots of success. And then we picked up Conan and did that. And then Infinity, you know, which is the... you know, based on the big miniatures game.
Yep.
And then Star Trek. And, you know, and Star Trek we got because of all the other licenses, because we could show to CBS that, you know, we could treat the brand well, that we could get a lot of, you know, we'd do a really good job and it was high quality. And then we picked up John Carter of Mars, which I'd been trying to get for ages, but they were tied up with their deal with Disney.
Yep.
And then we just got lucky, happened to... well, Rita met the guy from the estate, and we got chatting, and just, you know, right time, right place. And I'd also known the people at Bethesda for a few years talking about clothing from, you know, from the past. And, you know, at some point I had a light bulb moment going, wait a minute, I should talk to Bethesda because they've got Fallout and Elder Scrolls and all that cool stuff. And you know, I got talking to them and, you know, it was never, they didn't have a licensing team. They had a marketing manager who really wasn't interested in licensing. And eventually they got a licensing guy, this lovely guy, Mike. And I remember him calling me out of the blue, and I was walking in Hyde Park with Rita and it was a sunny day. I was like, oh, hi. So my idea was Fallout Warhammer. And he was like, sure, okay, sounds good. I was like, oh my God. Anyway, he was really busy, and it took, you know, a year and a half before we could get to a, you know, he had time and we could get in a, you know, basic agreement. And that deal happened, and then and that was for a miniatures game. So suddenly, yeah, I'd committed ourselves. We were a role-playing games company, and we had done miniatures for Star Trek and for John Carter and also Acting Cthulhu. And so that doubled the size of the company, because we had to get people to handle production and painting and sculpting and briefs and, oh gosh, everything. And demoing miniatures is a whole different thing, because role-playing games, you can send someone the PDF and go, hey, run this at a convention for me. Miniatures, excuse me, they've got to paint the miniatures. They've got to get some scenery made to make it look good. Or you've got to help them. So it's different.
And we know you weren't the one doing the painting.
No, definitely not. No. That wouldn't have been a very short-lived miniatures game if I did.
So I'd be curious, for people listening that obviously have not done what you've done, what is something that they don't know about this process, that they don't understand about taking an IP, and we're talking about big IPs now, we're talking about Star Trek, we're talking about Conan. What's a reality about that process that you think would surprise people?
It's a lot of work. It takes a long time to get to the point where you're holding a contract.
Yeah.
And a lot of talking and reassuring them that you know what you're doing. And like, so how are you going to do it? Show me something you've done. You need to be able to show them that you can create quality work.
Right.
And so that's why having your own baby, your own project first is great. Because it's like, look what we did. We can make a great looking product. So your first project is your calling card for everyone else. You need to be really good at sticking to their brand. You can't just go, oh, I've got this great idea to put guys in big suits of power armor in Star Trek, because that'll be cool.
Yeah.
No, Star Trek doesn't have that, you know. Other worlds do, but Star Trek doesn't. So you've got to prove that you know the world, or find someone who's really loves that world. And you've got to be able to prove that you can make it a commercial success. There's no point. They don't want to hear, oh, I'm going to do a Kickstarter, and if it's a success, we'll make the game. They want to hear, I'm making this game.
Yep.
I might use Kickstarter as a marketing platform to sell more product, but I'm making this game, and it is going in to go into shops. There will be distribution for it. You know, they want their brand to be bigger in retail. And you getting their game into retailers and getting it into the hands of people around the world is what they want to hear. They want to hear that you're going to pay them a load of money, because it's not worth their lawyer's time to do the contract with you otherwise. So if you're going after a tiny creator-owned license where it's just them on the end of the phone going, yeah, sure, let's do the deal. I'll, you know, send me a contract that you've done, then fine. But most cases, when you're talking about a license, you're talking to an agency or the brand themselves, and they've got a legal team, and they're going to want to know, you know, what are your terms? How are you going to release it? What territories do you want? What languages do you want? How much percentage of your net receipt are you going to pay? And how much of, and typically what happens is they go, well, how much money are you going to sell? How much money are you going to make over 3 years? Let's say that's $500,000.
Right.
Okay. So if the royalty is 10%, which is often the, you know, royalty, good royalty, that's $50,000. We want you to guarantee half of that, $25,000. And we'd like half of that up front,
$12,500.
Because, but this is big, you know, you are getting their brand, their fans, Yeah. Their artwork, their people, that's the cost. But, you know, you've got to be willing, you know, to put down some good money. So if you're guaranteeing $25,000 over 3 years, you know, you probably start with $10,000 down and maybe $5,000, what we call a minimum guarantee every year. So whatever happens, you have to give them another $5,000 of that minimum guarantee each year. So you've got to sell. And if you don't sell anything in that year, you're still paying them that money. But if you don't, if you're not selling, there's no point. Why have you got the license? You know. So once you've got a license, you now have this axe over your head of like, you have to go and sell this. But if you want something that badly and you want, you know, you're also using it to market your company. Like when we got, you know, Conan was a big thing for our company. We're like, hey, we've got the Conan license. Suddenly lots of fans who we've never spoken to are shopping on our web store. Like, oh, you've got this thing called Act of Cthulhu. That looks cool, you know. So it's both promotion for your business. It brings you new fans. It, you know, if you've got access to artwork, it's great. But, you know, with Star Trek, we could have used all the stills, but we wanted to do all new artwork rather than have people, you know, previous games had used the photographs from the shows. And we wanted to see people doing stuff in Star Trek uniforms that you've never seen on TV. Leaping over Burning Canyons and, you know, having fights in Star Trek horror, you know, all kinds of stuff. So, you know, so that cost us. And, you know, so you've got to be willing to spend the money to make a licensed brand really work. So it is a lot of work. It's a lot of cash commitment. It's a lot of, you know, you've got to be controlled. You've got to ensure that you know, you've got to be good at admin because you have to get everything approved. Every piece of art has to be approved. Everything you write has to be approved. And they will own all the art that you've paid for at the end of the project. And all the writing except the rules. The rules are yours, but they will own all the content that you write.
Isn't that something?
It's a lot.
I'm stressed out hearing the story, let alone running the company. So I'd be curious, Kristen, you may not be able to answer this, but now looking back over the, you know, the decade or so that you've been doing this, has there been a point where you turned to your wife and went, we may be a little bit over our head here, or we may have bitten off a little bit more than we could chew? Or were you guys always confident every step of the way?
I was. I think everyone who works for us has probably like gone, you're mad. You're never going to get this all done. So, no, I've never been, because I love doing it. And my philosophy is only work on projects you love. Don't take on something that you think you'll make lots of money with, but you don't love, because you're going to be doing it. You're going to have to cancel going out on Saturday night to see your friends to work on that project because something comes up.
Right.
It better be something you love, because otherwise you're going to hate yourself and you could earn more money doing another job with something that you also don't love. You know,
and we're coming right back to the advice you got when you were agent there.
So I've turned down some big tabletop projects because I knew I didn't love it and more other people loved it better. And, you know, I've gone after projects that maybe weren't as big, but because I love them and I knew we would do okay, if not better, and maybe in some cases we've done much better than we thought. And, you know, me and Rita aren't in it for the money. We're not here, you know, we're not going off to our yacht every summer and we're not looking to buy a yacht or anything. She's not a gamer. She loves being good
at her
job.
She's the sensible one.
Yeah, she is a very sensible one. And, you know, I do it because I love the creation of worlds and storylines and it's great seeing the people in our business, you know, grow with us and stuff and, you know, talking to people in the industry. So it's, you know, it's, you just really got to focus on, you know, the money will come at the end if you focus on what you care about.
Yep. So I'd be curious, Chris, when did you expand beyond and taking advantage of the logistics? So one of my purchases, I've purchased many things through you, but one of them was buying Forbidden Lands from Free Legan, because it was the best place for me to get it, right? And I'd already ordered stuff through you, so you'd already built enough credibility with me that I knew if I sent you money, it wouldn't be 6 months later before I got it. So as soon as I knew you had it, that's where I went. I bought it through. So when did that start to happen, where you started selling stuff that wasn't Modiphius?
Well, I knew Cubicle 7 did very well doing distribution for other publishers, or other creators, where they created a book and Cubicle 7 would print the book and distribute it. So what we did is go, well, okay, let's start off with people who've got a book or are about to make a book, and we can help them put it through our sales channels because we've already got the distribution, we've got the sea freight, we've got the logistics set up, we've got our website. So we did we worked out a fair deal with people, and we helped Free League launch Mutant Year Zero. Was the first game they did, which is also with Cabinet Entertainment, which is also the same people who look after Conan and Mutant Chronicles.
Wow.
So they, we worked with them and actually kind of co-published and co-funded the print run, and they did a Kickstarter and we worked together. And then, we started to do more stuff where simply, they would go, okay, we're going to be printing Tales from the Loop. How many do you think you'll need? And we'd said, okay, well, we'll need X thousand, for distribution. And then, at some point they went, actually, we can do this ourselves now. There's no point paying you the cut. And it's like, yeah, great. Sure. It's brilliant that they've grown that far, but we still sell their stock through our website. Excuse me. So, and, we're still friends and give advice and share print new printers and things like that.
That's great.
But we, there's lots of other companies like Cult and Electric Bastion Land was a new one I found. So kind of companies where they've got some stock, but they're just not big enough to get distribution, and we can handle that because we're doing it all day long, and it's
right.
Relatively easy for us to help. And of course, we've got 180,000 strong email list and big social media, so we can give them a bit of exposure and help them get more sales than maybe they would on their own. And now we've got a new thing called Via Modiphius, which is where we find a cool project, and actually at the moment it's all solo narrative based war games. So it's games that I've found, indie games that have something unique or special about them, where I've said, okay, we're going to do a new edition of it for distribution. So we actually kind of did the first version of that was the retail edition of Rangers of Shadowdeep by Joe McCulloch, who designed Frostgrave. And he was selling that in print on demand on Drive-Thru. And we were like, look, let's do a new edition, beautiful layout, and get it into stores because there's a big market and that's still selling. And then we did the same thing with Ivan Sorensen, who... he's got a company called Nordic Weasel, and he does a lot of games that are 5x from Y. So 5 parsecs from home, 5 leagues from the borderlands. So we took 5 parsecs from home and did a beautiful new retail edition, all gorgeous artwork, great layout. And it's, where is it? It's here. Just going to stores. There's a little beautiful.
It's gorgeous. It's an absolutely book. Gorgeous. Yeah.
Yeah. And that is a RPG light solo war game. So, and it procedurally generates a campaign around you. You've got like six crew, and the whole story unfolds. It's brilliant. I play it with Star Wars micro machines on a little tiny table. It's brilliant.
That's fantastic. That's
don't
fantastic.
Have to paint them. You see, they're all pre-painted.
And that's the key. That's yeah. The key.
And, yeah, and you've got your little micro machine ships flying around and stuff. So
that's great. But no, yes, it makes a whole lot of sense. You're taking advantage of the infrastructure that you had to build to support yourself, and at the same time empowering other creators. And it also sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it gives you an opportunity, being Chris Birch, to go out and go, that's cool. I want to be a part of this, or I want to upgrade what you're doing because I'm passionate about what you're making.
Yeah, and also we want to be known as the home of storytelling on the tabletop is the kind of the phrase we've come up with, but particularly with miniature games, I'm not interested in tournament games. There's plenty out there. There's no point competing with Games Workshop or Privateer Press or Fancy Flight's X-Wing. They all do it really, really well. And if a store's going to do a tournament, they're probably going to do X-Wing mm-hmm. or a GW tournament. So mm-hmm. do something different. I always love going against the tide. And so we've been, co-op board games have been big. Solo war games have always been a thing, but they, of course, exploded during lockdown. So we've really, all our Elder Scrolls and Fallout miniature games have a big solo side to them. which is one of my conditions for doing them at the beginning. And so with all these new solo war games, we're putting a flag in the sand. Like, we're going to be the home of, if you want to play solo or co-op,
go to Modiphius.
Come to us, because we're going to have all the awesome little innovative games that do everything a bit differently, but we're going to really encourage people to come to us and host those games. So,
well, and as you know, obviously I was a consumer of you before we ever started talking about you coming on the show, and here's a little bit of smoke for you to put up your butt. For me as a consumer, I knew, and that's why I couldn't spend my money fast enough buying Free League stuff through you, is because there's a reliability and a certain level of quality. I knew, because I hadn't, you know, I thought I wanted to play Forbidden Lands, but I knew if Chris was carrying it, like, I'm going to enjoy this. I'm going to get a quality product from it. And that's neat for you, Chris, to have over this time, to have these passions and these loves to then turn into a brand of quality, and both in content and in material. So congrats on that. That's a big deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's been my goal, is that anything we sell should be something I love.
Right.
So if you know, you see it on our shop, you know, I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you're not like Chris and you don't have the same taste as Chris has, and you know you don't want to buy it.
Yeah, that's true.
That's funny. So guys, we're going to take one more break, and I'm going to take full advantage of the fact that Chris has been neck deep in this industry for the past 10 years. And I want to talk about the industry itself and kind of what his thoughts are on how we've gotten where we are over the last 10 years, because a lot's changed, and maybe even try to pick his brain and see what's on the other side of things. We'll be right back. This is the part of many podcasts where someone comes on, interrupts the show, and explains that you should consider paying for the content that you're listening to right now for free. That pitch man explains by giving a dollar or more a month, you not only support the show, but you allow the show to grow and improve. Here on the third floor, we refuse to interrupt your episode of Tabletop Talk with such time-wasting pleas. We pledge never to run a spot asking you to go to patreon.com and give a dollar or more a month, because supporting content creators keeps the content coming. Even if there is a link in the show's description, and there is, we don't ask you to click it and become a patron. We don't waste time rambling about the benefits, like early access to episodes, getting episodes without ad breaks like this, or even getting a chance to play in one of Craig's RPG sessions. Anyway, enjoy this episode, knowing Tabletop Talk, despite being supported by its patrons, won't engage in such blatant appeals for support. So, obviously, you've been living and breathing tabletop gaming for, you know, at least the last 10 years. And, you know, it's been a revolutionary 10 years, both in role-playing and miniature gaming and board gaming. So much has changed from when you started, Chris. And now looking back at it, do you have a sense of what maybe the historians will say about this last 10 years? What have you seen? Let's use your narrative skills. What have you seen happening over the last 10 years that's interesting?
Well, I suppose, I mean, Kickstarter has allowed a huge increase in the quality of games. You know, whether it's beautiful looking role playing games with shock horror color art and great layout, and board games that are just mind blowing. You know, mind blowing levels of content.
Yeah.
I was always a solo gamer, and so I think it. I think COVID obviously has helped, but it was a growing trend, you know, with co-op board games. It was always like, can you play this co-op? Can you play this co-op? And I think the idea of playing together is way more fun than playing against someone, and that it allows you to tell much more stories, and storytelling has become bigger. You know, again, how often do you hear this is a narrative game for a board game, let alone a war game? So that trend, I think, was just something I saw coming, which is why we invested heavily in solo gaming, you know, solo war games. And, you know, it's a tricky thing is that we, you know, we've, there was the big flood of D20 products that kind of killed D20 back in the day. How many companies went bust?
And a few companies with it.
Yeah, for sure. And in a sense, we've had Kickstarter's given us a flood of games, but they're all, most of them are great. It's not that there's a lot of trash. There's a lot of great games. And the problem we've got, and this is the industry has been a problem for the last few years, is there's too much. There's too many great games. Shops don't know what to stock. Distributors don't care. No distributor out there goes, I love your game. I'm going to take 10,000 of this and I'm going to sell it because it's beautiful. Because if they miss it, they've got another great game tomorrow and on Friday and on next Monday. There's like every few days, there's another game soliciting that is amazing and that some of the customers want. So it's very hard for distributors to keep games in quantity to support retail because there's too many. I mean, there's something like 50 gaming products coming out every week.
Unbelievable.
And if you're a distributor that's got to carry that in bulk, that's really hard. If you're a retailer, I remember when, you know, the new hotness shelf at a retailer was like kind of there for a month. And now it's changing.
Four boxes.
Yeah, yeah. And now it's changing every week.
Yeah.
so that's a real problem. And of course, Kickstarter is also, whilst, you know, it's contributed to this situation. I'm not saying it's a problem because we're in a golden age of having so much choice. But, you know, you've got a lot of companies now that only sell through Kickstarter because they can only afford to sell the big $150 box of miniatures because there's no way they can sell it through stores. And they've got a big audience that buy direct. So why wouldn't they take that margin? I saw an interesting comment the other day. I think it was the board game trading site on Facebook. How many of you have found that great board game that you've been dreaming of all your life? And it does everything. It ticks every box. And it's amazing. And the miniatures are incredible. And the rules are so great. And you love playing it. And now you've got a new one. And that's really amazing. And that's really great. And it ticks all the boxes. And that one that you answered all your prayers is on the shelf, gathering dust. And we've just got too much. And maybe COVID was a bit good in a sense because everyone scaled back their releases. You had to, and we scaled back our releases. It made everyone think. And now we've got this like triple the cost of shipping out of China on sea freight. That's making everyone think twice about China production. But there isn't huge, you know, you cannot just go and make a board game in America. Because it would, your $150 game will suddenly be $500. Your $50 game will be $100, you know, if you're lucky. So, and with games becoming more mass market, they need to be cheaper. And, you know, you've got Target and Walmart starting to stock tabletop games in bulk now, and they're not going to pay, you know, for a $150 game. And, you know, and I love co-op dungeon crawl games. You know, they're probably one of the biggest genre. We all love that new shiny, and I love seeing the new one and the cool new rules it does and the different way of doing it and the different story it can give us. But I'm also sometimes despair, and it's another big box of plastic miniatures. And we're guilty of that too. You know, we just did Siege of the Citadel, which is like
you have no ground to stand on
this
here,
high.
Chris.
Yeah, no. But it's just so much. And then you think, do I really need another box of fantasy miniatures? Yeah, no. But, you know, it is a bit sad that we, you know, and it's not like the plastic's going to waste and it's getting chucked in the ocean because people don't throw away boxes of plastic miniatures. But it is a bit sad that we're in this state where there's too much good stuff and we actually aren't playing the great games that we've got. You can't just tell new creators, sorry, you can't make new games.
Yeah.
There isn't an answer really. But I have a feeling, you know, COVID might have been the start of something, and maybe increasing conditions in China will make it harder. But I feel like there needs to be less product because
it's not sustainable.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are more and more people buying games. So in a sense, you know, the Kickstarters get bigger. I mean, look at the Witcher Kickstarter. It's what, £3.5 million. The last month there was Renegade. Not Renegade. Another company did the there was $1 million for a solo game on Kickstarter.
Incredible.
And you know, it's been quite a few really big Kickstarters over the last few months. That just, you're just like, oh my God, can it really get bigger? Yes, it can. And so clearly there's a lot of people out there. There's more and more people, I think, coming into the industry. So yeah, maybe it is somewhat sustainable. And you know, the tabletop industry is a fraction of the big wider world.
Yeah.
You know, you could double the size of the table industry and it would still be a minuscule part of the, you know, global industry.
It is. It's interesting as you mentioned that, Chris, because in my interview with Steve Jackson, that was the big thing that he said. And he didn't say it from necessarily, you know, there's too much out there and I can't, you know, can't get my stuff out there. That wasn't his perspective. His perspective was very much close to yours, which is there's a lot of good games that aren't getting played. There's a lot of good games that are getting made, and he called it the garbage pile. And then because of the churn, they end up, you know, getting put on the shelf. And that's what he felt as well. It's a crying shame.
It is. I mean, it's so sad. I mean, I've got really great games that, I mean, I'm 53 now, and you get to the point where you go, I wonder if I'll ever play that again before I die.
It's not when, it's if.
No. Yeah. So it is sad that there's so many great games. And also, you know, and for the last year, none of us have really been able to meet up properly. But even before that, my gaming group was once a Tuesday, and then, you know, someone had a baby and someone moved away. And, you know, you start to meet less and less. And so it's harder and harder to get a game. And when you get a game in, sometimes you go back to the tried and tested favorites. You don't often try out new stuff because it's a lot of effort to get it to the table.
And teach it. And, yep.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's, I don't think there's any answer out there. And, you know, if you'd said to me when I was entering the industry, like, try not to make too many games because there's a lot of us making great games already, you know, we'd be like, no, yeah, of course not. So, and, you know, and we thrive on new great ideas. We want people to create new great ideas, and the companies of the future are being formed on Kickstarter and in people's bedrooms now. You know, I think, you know, hopefully the industry, the population of our in tabletop world will grow so that, you know, all those secondhand amazing games we've got will find new homes and we can afford to buy new ones.
Amen. So I'd be curious, is there anything that you are seeing now or smelling now that gets you excited or you think it's interesting? Or if people are listening to this in this 2 years from now, will they go, ooh, Chris called that one. What's on the horizon that you that you're looking at, do you think?
3D printing.
Ooh, interesting. Okay. So, how so?
Yeah, we just did some research with our Star Trek audience and our Fallout miniatures audience and the Star Trek role-playing audience. You wouldn't expect them to be fans. So of the Fallout audience, 33% of them didn't have a 3D printer and not planning to get one. 33% of them did. And this is like 3,000 or 4,000 people. And 33% are thinking of getting one. So that audience is doubling.
That's huge.
And this research was done before COVID, right? And we know from one of the really big 3D printing sites that the number of people backing Patreons for 3D printing, buying 3D printing, has gone from about 8,000 to 38,000 in the last year. Yeah, insane growth. So the role-playing audience, 50% said they had not got a 3D printer and weren't thinking of getting one. 25% had a 3D printer. 25% were thinking of getting one. The audience is also doubling.
Wow.
So the people with 3D printers are doubling and trebling, you know, and it's growing really fast. So I think, you know, anyone who makes miniatures in the old way, I mean, we do. We've got a factory that's still growing. We're probably going to double the size for next year because we still can't make enough. needs to be thinking about this in the future. We already have, we're one of the first companies to sell a licensed range of 3D printed products for tabletop gaming, Fallout and Elder Scrolls. So we've really embraced it and dived in, and it's gone really, really well. And so I think that, you know, the trouble with 3D printers at the moment, it would be like me going, here's a color printer, but you need to watch a few YouTube videos to make sure right. that the color prints right. And Julie, with her video, thinks that you need these 17 settings to get blue right. And yep. Dave has these other 27 settings to make sure it even sticks to the paper in the first place. Yep. It's crazy, right? Yep. But it's only a matter of a few years. They keep getting cheaper and more simpler every year. There's already some software called Simplify 3D, which is amazing for getting 3D printers working. But, you know, it's... we're a few years off where you can just go home and go, I fancy a new unit of orc archers for my gaming, and I'm going to press the button and they'll be ready for me in the morning, and I can literally take them off the printer and start playing with them. Even color versions, you know, because you can 3D print in color. So it's before you have your HP home 3D printer that just works and you don't need to be a programmer to use it. It's a few years away, but it's not far off. It's the you should be thinking about how you can use 3D printing in your gaming. If you're a designer, that is, and there isn't a Halo for 3D printing like there was a Halo for Xbox yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we're working on some ideas that might be that killer app, and we've got a big project launching that we're announcing this summer. That is launching episodically with 3D printing as an intrinsic Very cool. part of it as well. And it's a new version of 2D20 as well that will teach you how to play from the moment you open the book. So you don't have to read character creation. That's you literally big. Just start playing.
That's very, very big. I agree with you, Chris. I think that the demand is one of those rare times where the demand is way ahead of way over the skis of the technology. Mm, yeah. But to your point, it's just a matter of time. The demand is too great, right?
Think about how technology changes. Yeah,
exactly. At some point, someone's going to put out that 3D printer that becomes the HP color printer for everybody. Everybody, that's what you buy, right? And what prevents me from doing it is I don't have the time. Yes. And right now it's a hobby.
It's
right?
Big it's, times. I mean, it's not just a hobby. It's like, here is all the, go and make the plastic Lego bits before you stick the Lego bits together. Here's how to mold Lego. It's very into, I mean, you know, for some people, it's a fun hobby because you can, The cool thing is you can 3D print new parts for your printer to make it print better. I mean, that's insane, like, that you can do that. And it's, you know, for people who love that technical side, it's great fun.
And right now I enjoy paying those people to print stuff for me.
Yes.
But eventually that'll change, right, where I won't have to and that gap will fill.
But we're going to have a new store in the summer where you can buy all our stuff 3D printed. Well, all the in the 3D printed range if you've not got a 3D printer. So that's going to get bigger and bigger as well, I think. So.
Yeah. Well, and it's to your point, companies like you need to start thinking about it now because – you know, again, there's a runway. You don't just switch your business model overnight to make that happen.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah.
So, Chris, is there obviously I'm going to link to the website here in the show notes. If people want to get more Modiphius or more Chris Birch, where should they go outside of just the website?
Well, Facebook. / Modiphius on Facebook and Twitter / Modiphius and Instagram and YouTube it's a whole bunch of places to find us chatting away. I'm always usually chattering away in the community on Facebook.
Wonderful.
So usually easy to find there. And yeah.
With all this free time that you have.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And last but not least, is there anything that we have not talked about, Chris, that it's important that everybody listening knows about? Is there a product that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure people?
Well, we probably should just make a point that, you know, we brought Act and Cthulhu back this year. It's now come out for 2D20 and it's all new artwork and it's kind of more pulp two-fisted punch Cthulhu in the face, and a Nazi at the same time.
And a cool engine. It's amazing how well the engine fit, and it's good, Chris.
And then, you know, and of course we've got Dune and the Fallout role-playing games, which are landing this summer, and 5 Parsecs, if you want a cute little kind of indie project, is definitely worth checking. And then keep your eye out for the summer for our big new announcement, which is in the same universe as Acting Cthulhu.
That's exciting. That's very, very exciting. Well, Chris, I can't thank you enough. This was very generous of you to come on, and I really enjoyed this, and I hope that at some point I can talk you into coming back.
For sure. Yeah, no problem.
Wonderful. Thanks for those of you that's thank you. For those of you that sat through all of this, I appreciate you too. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.
Take care. Bye.
This episode, subscribe to Tabletop Talk and share it with your friends. Check out our content on YouTube and Twitch. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and stay updated on everything coming from Third Floor. All the links are in the show notes. Take care, floorheads.
All right, this is great. How are you on time, Chris? I don't want to steal. You're doing okay. Good.
Yeah, good.
All right. So, what makes the most sense first here, Chris? For you, what games do you want to talk about first? Do you want to work backwards? Do you want to work forwards?
Don't mind.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. However it comes.
Yeah. All right. Oh, that was fantastic, Chris. Thank you.
All right. No worries.
One quick favor. Your mic is scratching on your shirt. Can we straighten out the wire just a little bit? Perfect.
Don't know if it's...
It's not, like, terrible, and I'll be able to get rid of it, but...
Yeah, sure.
Okay. It'll save me an hour of editing, so I appreciate it.
I'll try and...
Don't stress too much about it. I don't want it to be a distraction, because we've got a good groove going, my friend. Good groove.
All right.
I'll bring us back. Star Trek Adventures, Dune, Mutant Chronicles. Now, outside of the... try that again. Outside of the 2D20, they've delivered some recent... I'm struggling. Who wrote this? We can keep this real short, Chris.
Sure.
Because we're coming at an hour and a half here. The idea here is I would love to get, you as an observer and as a participant, what you think has happened over the last 10 years. And then any things that you're excited about. And we can talk about things you're excited about from Modiphius. But I'd like to also know, is there things that you're seeing happening that you think are very exciting, or anything you see happening that are concerning? Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome. Okay.
Hey, are you still here? Wow. Well, the episode is over, but if you're bored, why not go to patreon.com and support the show for as little as $1 a month? Yeah, you can just scroll down and get the link. It's Patreon that makes this and all of our other content possible. Don't you want to join the other floorheads on the Patreon Discord? Anyway, thanks for sticking around. Take care.